This, well, we didn't, we assumed we were. Yeah. Yes, we assumed we were.
Yeah.
This is where, in the event of a hostility, the worst case, of course, was the one of no warning. And that was where this recall.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we had, you could write scenarios until you were blue in the face, and every scenario for every exercise was a different one. And boy, and I've really found that out down at NORAD, but that's a later story. Many of the scenarios where they would begin to build up for an exercise, it would begin to build up 48 hours beforehand, before the exercise really got the first indication, intelligence reports, pseudo-intelligence reports of something happening. And then, of course, there would come a time when we would have to make a decision to call the troops in. And I suppose most of our exercises were of that nature, where there was an escalation in tension. And then we would reach the point where we would say, all right, a recall, everybody on base. And then you'd get to the point where if it had been real life, real time, we would have bombed, had the aircraft bombed up. And then they would be ready to go. Now, we didn't do that in peacetime because just of the risk of having, the security aspects would be the word, the security aspects of having those airplanes bombed up for any given length of time and the problem of adequate protection in accordance with the peacetime regulations of the USA, of the United States, it wouldn't have been possible. But we would have under wartime conditions, real threat. So that a launch would have gone at the first indication of something happening, the first attack or whatever it would be, even if we only got them in the air. And we did that. We had to do that. We did actually, not with weapons on them, but sometimes the scenario would require us to take off and actually circle the airfield, just fire on them, just keep the airplanes in the air until they had to be refueled, and then bring them down, refuel them, and take off again. Now, this was awfully hard on the aircrew, because they were just flying around, boring holes in the sky, terribly boring. But it was sometimes that was the way the exercise would go, and then bring them down, and then the word would come, launch, go, which would come down from higher headquarters.
Yeah.
So, and as a part of the exercises, of course, bases would be written off. They would be attacked, and sometimes we were written off. And when that happened, we just told the base to stand down, because as far as the base was concerned, it was written off. It was gone. So if they had any airplanes airborne, then the airplanes had to land at one of the other wings, or a place that was still operating.
Yeah.
And we used to wind up with airplanes all over the bloody place.
RAF
airplane, air bases, German air bases, wherever there was an airfield that was still operating.
What about French air bases?
No, because France by this time was not playing ball at all in exercises. They did in competition, scarcely enough, and that comes up again in the next phase of this whole thing. Yeah.
Now, there's one other question I have, unless you have...
No, that's...
And, of course, this is, again, intended from a security point of view. If you have, as we have had over quite a few years, God knows how many pilots, 100, 200, 300 more pilots, who have gone through the system and who have knowledge of, you know, the first strike targets and all that sort of
thing.
That's
right.
How in the name of heavens is this kept quiet?
Just because of the caliber of the people. They were all, everybody had to be cleared top secret, and all the pilots had to have a special security, which was for nuclear aspects.
Yeah.
And I guess it's, again, a part of the training, you're quite right. There were hundreds of aircraft.
Hundreds.
Through tour expired people. Once they left the Air Division, it would almost as if they just closed their mind. That was it. Bing. As if a blind was pulled down. And I never heard, myself personally, any of the people in ex-air crew, and I had a lot of them in, through various connections later, never once did the question of targeting ever come up in discussion. I would never raise it, and they would never raise it.
Yeah.
And to my knowledge, I have never heard of anyone ever speaking of targeting once he got away from the air division.
We would have nothing to do with selecting targets ourselves.
No. This would all No, it was done by NATO. Yes, done by SACEUR in relation to what he felt were the primary targets. And remember, this is now almost a pseudo-strategic sense. Pseudo-strategic. We're talking about short-range airplanes. But we're talking about almost strategic targets before you get into a tactical war. The follow-up strikes, if we had any airfields were ever operating again after the initial strike, then and some of the exercise did go along those way, that way, then you began to get into the business of, well, I'll tell you the other thing that could happen, too, and, oh boy, scenarios, you can write them by the thousands. You'd have a situation where, for whatever reason, the president refused to release nuclear weapons. And the war, the ground war, had started in a conventional sense. And it would only be a matter of hours before the field commanders of the land forces were screaming for tactical weapons because they were being overrun, literally overrun. And the only hope they had of halting this rapid advance was through the use of tactical weapons, both the ones that they had in integral to their own organization, as well as the tactical air forces. So that, there were occasions in the exercise where the first weapons to go were not the pre-targeted ones, but were on a tactical sense, where now the priority had switched to supporting the land forces. And there, the boys now had to, it was like targets of opportunity. Now they had to get the maps and the location and then fly a route that would take them to assist the back up the army. But those were the cases. The various scenario writers did this to try and figure out or to think of every possible thing that might happen, and one of the things that was very often was, and it appeared quite frequently, was a reluctance on the part, where in the writing the president had not given the green light for the use of nuclear weapons for whatever reason. It was never explained. It didn't have to be explained because this is the way that exercise was being written. So, when that happened, when an exercise did go that way, it kind of threw things into a bit of a ball. Yes, it did. As opposed to that nice cut-and-dried thing, although it was a disastrous situation, the cut-and-dried one, which was the pre-planned strike. So, but I... There it was.
Okay, we're going to get into the politics now.
Let me finish with the other one. There's a third aspect of this, which is important, and that is the competitions. I can deal with those quite quickly, and then I don't know whether we should leave the politics, because politics is, there's a lot involving in politics, and we might leave that till the next one. Competitions. And aside from the exercises and the tackle valves, there was this third element, which were exercises, and this was PR. This was almost showmanship. And so far, I've talked entirely about the strike and conventional weapons, the iron bombs, or the strike attack role, as it was called. There was also the other role in the air division, which was the photo reconnaissance. So we had the two roles. And we had one wing that was purely photo reconnaissance. So they did not have nuclear weapons.
And you mentioned that, though.
I've mentioned it earlier on, but I have... They played their part in all these exercises, too, where they had to go out and take photographs of certain spots and come back. But now we get to the competition part. And the competitions, there were always two during the year, one for the PR, or the photo reconnaissance people, and then the other one for the strike attack one. And the photo reconnaissance one, you each wing or headquarters selected people who would represent the division, in our case the air division, in this competition. And we would, say, send a team of four airplanes. And there would be, say, eight pilots to go along. Similarly, for the nuclear attack role, for that competition, we'd do the same thing. We'd send four airplanes and, say, eight pilots. Now, the exercise would last as long as, 4 or 5 days. It was, and during that, the rules of the competition were like any other competition. For example, you couldn't exchange an airplane. You couldn't exchange a pilot. You were limited in the number of ground crew you could send along to look after your airplane. And it was a minimum, and a bare minimum. There were set, if you like, set exercises. For the photo reconnaissance people, one day there would be a certain type of target that would have to be located. I'd be given X amount of information. And for the sake of argument, four of the pilots would have to do that type of one. The next day, there would be a different type of a photo reconnaissance exercise, and the rest would have to do that day. And you had your own photo interpretation people, you had your own photo development people. It was just like a small, very small wing, if you will. But there were the French. Now, this is where the French came in. The French took part in the photo reconnaissance because they thought they were the kings of the photo reconnaissance and were winning every bloody competition in the world. They were good on the photo reconnaissance. They, of course, did not take part in the strike attack because they didn't have at that time, they didn't have the nuclear weapons. Well, these competitions were extremely important because of from a morale point of view and from a PR point of view, because they were given good press coverage. And all these various teams would all go on one airfield. So everybody was operating from the same airfield under the same conditions, whether it was pouring with rain or whatever it might be, and had to fly the same routes from the same base using the same nav aids and their own equipment, cars, and what have you. Well, when we started, when I arrived in the Air Division, we were just getting into the photo reconnaissance role. We were not into it very, very, very far. We were building up this new role. And the first exercise that we went into, J-First Papers, we did extremely poorly. We were bottom of everybody, because this was absolutely new. We hadn't done any photo reconnaissance since World War II. And after we'd moved to LAR, we had one more exercise, and we did a little better, but boy, we were still way down. And the French were running away with this thing. So I got together with the wing seal, and I said, look, we've got to do something about this. Now, the French are, what they're doing, we don't know, but whatever it is, they're good. Now, you arrange, you get hold of the French liaison officer, and you arrange to go and visit some of these wings. We'll send some airplanes down. We'll get permission to fly in. And if we can't fly in with our aircraft, then we'll use our Dakota, our transport airplane, and we'll fly in using the transport airplane, not flying in the operational machine. Well, we did, and the boys bellied up to the bar with these French, and then they began to find out just how these French were doing so damn well.
These French-speaking pilots
and all that. Yes, although a lot of the French spoke English, curiously enough, and it was a question of both. And when the teams, and they would go to their various recce wings in the French Air Force, in France, and then the boys would come back, and then they'd all get together and compare notes and find out what they were doing. And by God, they learned an incredible amount from the French in short order, to the point that the next one, by God, if we didn't win the bloody thing. And the French were just, they were mad as hell, because they had always been tops in this thing. Yeah. And not only did we win that year, but then we won the next year as well. So it wasn't just chat. Yeah. By that time, of course, our people... you were asking earlier why were our people so good? I think the other thing was that being professionals and having been exposed to so much, Learning was an easy process for our people. It seemed that we could pick up something very quickly. Our people had enough experience that when something new came along, even though it was something they hadn't really been associated with before, they could grasp it quickly and then make the thing work. And then having grasped it, they would then take it. They wouldn't let go. They keep dogging it until they improved on what they had taken over in the first instance. And this is what happened in this particular sense. Our people began to improve on the French and never look back. Now, I don't know what happened after I left, because I lost touch. And once I got out, of course, down the States, I lost touch with any of the reports and so forth. But I know the wings always have done extremely well in this photo reconnaissance. Oh, even to the question of the developing procedures. Quick, how to get the prints made as quickly as possible and then distributed. And gosh, we developed our own system, which was probably the best in Europe. And after photographs were taken, we could get photos to 4 ATAF in very short order, and I mean short order. Again, we're talking in terms of minutes, not hours, from the time. It was good.
Putting them over the wire, you mean?
No. Actual photographs. Yeah, the actual photographs. Yeah. It was. Again, it was the ingenuity of the Canadians and of saying, well, damn it, these photographs are no good if they're stale. So how do we get them there fresh? And going through it, thinking of ways of improving delivery, of improving the processing of the equipment, photos, getting equipment and actually working on the photographic development equipment that we had, because it was automatic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Even technological development right there of saying, you know, we can cut 30 seconds off that, or we can cut 45 seconds off that, and so forth. Mm-hmm. Well, they did extremely well on the bombing right away. Quick, the bombing was taking off and then flying a given route and being given a time on one of the ranges, the bombing ranges.
Ah, yeah.
And then actually having to deliver with a practice bomb, drop a practice bomb, and return. And of course, time on target was extremely important, and the other was the accuracy of the bomb itself.
Yeah.
So, and they again, the teams, each pilot had to fly X number of sorties during the period of this competition, which again, as I say, would be 4 or 5 days. And the results were posted at the end of each day on a bloody great big board, so everyone could see how it was an international thing, and it was a national approach, so one could see how nationally, as well as between ATAFs, because there were 2 ATAF and 4 ATAF, so you had an inter-ATAF, but that really meant a national competition, so everyone could see how everyone was standing up. And God, the bloody Canadians, there was one competition and it was very close. This was a bombing competition. Very, very close. And I was, I didn't go near them because they didn't like visitors on the airfield while the competition was going on, because it was just too damn busy and you had to fly in. But they would make exceptions if you pushed hard enough. Well, we were going through a period in the air division when we were very, very short of engines. Terribly short of engines. We were having there was a failure in one of the fans that was causing us great problems. And at this particular stage, just as we went into this exercise, we didn't have a single spare engine in the air division. In other words, every engine we had was in an airplane. That was it. All of our engines were back here in North America in the plant, and they were stacked up because the parts that had to be made, they had to be machined, and they just weren't available. So there was it was a lead time problem. Well, we went into this exercise and oh boy, this is going to be tough, because if we lose an engine, we don't have any spares. And we weren't allowed to put a spare on the site. If anything went wrong, it was a question of flying it in. They were allowed to take small running spares, but major spares, not allowed. Well, lo and behold, God, the competition is running down, and we at headquarters, Laura had the daily reports on how we stood and so forth. She said it was a very tight one with the, I guess it was the Americans. Maybe it was, I can't remember whether it was the Americans or the Brits, but it was very tight. And we were coming down to the last day of the competition, and it was obvious that the last few sorties flown on that day were going to decide this competition. And we had, there were a couple of sorties, or a number were flown early in the morning. And I got reports, and we had a couple how were they graded? They were perfect sorties, literally perfect sorties. The timing was right on. You had to be over the target within a matter of 5 seconds or something like this. And the boys were bang on, and the bombing was superb. Even one was a direct hit, which was very rare.
Yeah, that
but it was the kind of score that put you right up. And then, I guess it would be about noon, the roof fell in. We had an engine failure from the airplane. Just got on the deck, and there we were. Because the others, while they had not done quite as well as our morning sorties had, they had done extremely well.
Yeah.
And if we missed a sortie, then we were going to lose the competition. And no spare engine. Well, God, I got home and Sasso said, what do we do? And it was Sasso, he said, we're going to have to fly an engine in. And I said, yeah, we don't have one. He said, we're going to have to fly it in a bird, and then take it out of that airplane, and put it in the airplane that's there. And I said, holy mackerel. Of course. Well, we're going to have to move awfully fast because these sorties, the last sortie was something like about 6 or 7 o'clock that night. And here we are now after lunch. Well, we decided that we'd give it a whirl. Now, we had 2 aero engine people. That's all we were allowed. There were a couple of corporals. One was a French-speaking corporal, as a matter of fact. They were good. They'd been very carefully selected. They were good. So we said, we got on the phone, and we said, here, what we'll do is we'll fly in there. The only engine we can do is fly one in an airplane. Now, you start and take the engine out of the aircraft that's sick. And then as soon as the other one lands, you'll have to start to take it out and then move it into the tail number that's a part of the competition, and let's hope and pray that we can get it done in time for that last sortie to be flown. Well, my God, that we immediately launched an airplane, and it flew in, and the boys just about had the engine out of the 104 on the ground. And as soon as that aircraft taxied up, they're working with a hot engine.
Yeah, I know,
they started to work on it, and they got that damn engine out, and they put it into the new bird, and this is all within the matter. The whole process was under 4 hours. The whole process under 4 hours. And that I went in now because I realized that this was terribly urgent, and I wanted to see this,
yeah.
So I flew in to the base. I forget where it was now. German base, I think. And got there and watched these two corporals work on that bloody engine. Now, changing an engine in a 104 is a big, difficult, long job. It's a big engine. You're working in very confined space within the skin of it because it's right up against the skin. Terrible. Well, these rascals did it, and we were all looking at our watches because we had, as they finished, we had about 5 minutes to go to launch time for that bloody airplane. Now, if anything was wrong with that engine, then, of course, it couldn't take off. After all, flight safety was still paramount.
Yeah.
And the pilot that was to fly that bird was standing by, and he had all his maps and everything. He was ready to go. He climbed in. I should say that normally after an engine change, you go through a run-up and test everything, make sure it's all right. And he said, I'll do it. I'll test it. And with that, he got into the airplane, and he did a complete run-out, and he just gave a thumbs up like that and waved the chocks away, and he taxied out right on his bloody time he was supposed to have left the dispersal to get to his takeoff point. And not only that, but he came back with a perfect score.
My God.
Well, gee, of course, again. And by this time, I should also say that I was not the only spectator, because all around the airfield, the word had gone, of course, that the Canadians were in trouble.
Yeah.
they were. That's right. Exactly. And so there was an this airplane and these two corporals became the center of attention of all the nations, all the nationalities. And there was this awful crowd of people around watching these two boys work. And by God, when that plane taxied out and took off, they all clapped. And they all applauded. Boy, when he came back with a perfect score. Oh, mackerel. Again, they won the competition. That's right. But people just walked away shaking their hands. You can't do that kind of thing. It's just not possible. And these two lads, of course, we made an awful fuss of them, as you can imagine, because we couldn't help them. They were on their own. And it was up to them. And they knew they were front and center. But by God, they produced. They didn't make a single mistake. There was no hiccup. If they had, of course, it would have shown up in the engine test. Yeah. And they did everything perfectly. So, it was great. It really was astounding. And that went right throughout the ATAS, too, about those bloody Canadians. And you should have seen what those two corporals did in changing an engine. Again, the Canadians almost became a myth in the sense of what they could do. So I relate the story because it's my best story just how good our ground crew were. You know, I've talked about our pilots, but it shows just how good our ground crew were. They were superb as well as our bomb load crews. And I'll get back to bomb load crews a little later on when I get into the politics. But all of these things just made you feel terribly proud. Yeah. My God, just extremely proud. And knowing full well that if the chips ever went down, there was one group in shape that Sacker could count on. No two ways about it. So anyway, that was the bombing competitions. And now, of course, they changed it. We're not in the nuclear weapon business anymore. Yeah. And I'm not too sure quite how they run the competitions now, but... and they undoubtedly do, but I don't know. I'm not too sure how our people are doing now using conventional bombs. Yeah. See, some of those deliveries of those nuclear weapons, there were various ways of delivering a nuclear weapon, and one of them was what they call over the shoulder, which is just before we wrap up this one this morning, might explain one thing that we're talking about: a fighter airplane with a bloody great big weapon on it, a big bomb physically. And the boy up front, he doesn't have a bomb sight. He's not like a bomber, where there's a bombardier sitting up front with a very superb piece of equipment which assists him in bombing accurately. Our people didn't have a bomb sight. It was all done literally by eyeballing it, as we said. And one of the most difficult deliveries was the low-level one, where you had low-level delivery, where you had to get up to a sufficient altitude before the thing exploded, so that you weren't caught in the explosion itself.
Yeah.
And this was known as, one of the techniques was over the shoulder, where you'd come in literally on the deck, and as soon as you recognized your target, you'd pull up into a climb, and as you came up into the top, and you're pulling G, then you would release your bomb, and the bomb would then sort of keep going, and then come down behind you. In the meantime, then, after the bomb had gone, you would continue a straight climb to get as high as you possibly could before that bomb went down. And we're talking about terminal velocity here now, and talking in terms of seconds, before the bomb exploded, and hope that you'd be far enough away that you would survive the explosion itself. Now, the over-the-shoulder bombing technique, there was nothing. It literally called for you to come in and then pull up. And at a certain point, when you're pulling a fair amount of G, to release this weapon, which would then continue a trajectory and come down behind you. So, to be accurate with that kind of Heath Robinette bombing called for a lot of practice, and it was a question of accurate flying, right amount of G, and knowing when to push the button and to release the weapon, the practice bomb. So that the bombing, accurate bombing using that technique was difficult. And when you start to get hitting the target using that technique, you've got people who who have worked and individually have developed a system that is absolutely perfect. So I only mention that to make sure how difficult the bombing was. It was not just straight and level.
That I can see.
So I think these bombing techniques were extremely important, and they call for a lot of practice. Part of the day-to-day training in the air division for the nuclear role people was to get time on the various bombing ranges in Europe, and then go and make the most of the time we had. Have just aircraft just coming in one after another for the half an hour or the 45 minutes we might have been able to get a range on a daily basis, and just aircraft just streaming in, and sometimes people dropping more than one bomb going in. Now this is to get the bombing practice as opposed to the cross-country. They'd get there doing a cross-country run, making use of all the hours on the airplane so we wouldn't waste hours, make use of the hours to get there, but having gotten there, then drop more than one bomb because of the time factor on the range. It took time for the boys to reach this kind of level, some of them became superb. Some of them were just masters, literally masters. You just shake your head. You'd say, that's just not on. But it would be.
When you think of that, as compared to, your own session.
Oh, yes.
Session World War.
Sure. Good heavens. Yeah, truly we thought the Heath at Robinish. No aid here at all. Just the old seat of the pants.
Well, that's okay. Lovely, Reg. And
I guess now that then means that we're ready then to perhaps they might clean up the air division now.
And into the politics.
The politics side of it, yes, because there's a fair amount on the politics. And it's a very important, I think, aspect because of the time period.
Now, we have a...
next one is all of...